We've come out to Hollywood, California. We're in the Cecil B. DeMille building on the lot at Paramount Pictures. And I can hardly believe we're here. How many times have we seen the mountain and the stars on the screen?
Yeah.
But we're behind that gate now with one of the stars of radio's Great Days and so many other things, too. Elliot Lewis is with us, and we're happy to be here and happy to have a chance to talk with you, Elliot.
It's a pleasure to have you here and to have nice weather for you and to welcome you to Paramount and the mountain and that beautiful backing they have that they just put up. Maybe noticed it when you drove in, behind the tank, which will be the setting for the new Barbary Coast show, which I would guess had better be an enormous hit after looking at the work they put into that tank. Or they'll never pay for it, and they're going to have to sell this whole building. You may have seen the last of this lot.
It may close any time.
May close any time if that show doesn't work.
You know, I have long waited for an opportunity to tell you face-to-face that you and Phil Harris on the radio as Phil and Frankie Remley were to radio, in my mind, what Laurel and Hardy were to movies and what Gleason and Kearney were to television.
Well, thank you. I remember those days with the utmost fondness. I don't know when in my life I have so enjoyed a job. It was just absolutely marvelous job. When I realized that we did that for 9 years, Phil and Alice and I, and Walter Tetley and Sheldon Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, to digress a moment, I had not acted in 20 years or 22 years or something. Sheldon Leonard is acting and hadn't acted in a long time. He's doing a new show called Big Eddie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hi Averback, who's another friend, is the producer and director of the show. They called me 3 weeks ago and said, you want to come over and have some fun? And I said, doing what? And they sent me a script, and it was cute, and I'm on Saturday night.
Are you?
First time. I haven't seen it. Everybody said, gee, it was well. But I remembered those days because working with Sheldon suddenly reminded me of what fun that had been. Acting in comedy, I mean, in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. I don't particularly like to act. I don't enjoy it. But I do like that. I had a marvelous week, and it reminded me of what you just said, which I hadn't thought of in I don't know how long, but that was the exact same thing on that show. It was just fun. It was just wonderfully refreshing, the two characters and the way it played and the relationships.
Well, the rapport that you guys had was marvelous. And
well, you know, Jack Benny, who was my teacher, really, I was here in Los Angeles when I was still going to school. I was going to junior college down here. And right across the street is the KHJ building. When I was 18, I worked over in that building. It was then NBC. It had just been built. And I worked in that building for Jack Benny. And then on and off I worked for him for whenever, all of those years.
You mean on the air?
On the air as an actor, never playing Remley. Always another character, because Remley never appeared until he appeared on the Harris show. But Jack was always fond of Phil and me and of what we were doing and was most helpful and kind of guided us and gave suggestions and everything. And I remember sitting down with him one day and I said, please explain something to me. I know that when Phil and I work that it's funny and the jokes are funny, but I don't understand why the laughs are so big. What are we doing? He said, well, you found a wonderful thing in that relationship, you two guys. The two of you say and do what everybody in the audience would like to say and do in a similar situation if they had the nerve. But nobody has that kind of nerve that you two guys have, and that's what people are laughing at. They're just delighted. Because it always surprised me. You know, we'd say something, you know, like you stick Tetley in the oven, and he says, let me out, and you just wait and say, what do you think? You know, people are screaming. And it is, as you think about it, it's ridiculous. You don't leave somebody in an oven. But that we would even consider it and think about it and stand there and say, well, I don't know whether, you know, and talk about it. And this poor soul is in the oven screaming and yelling and banging on the oven door. So it's very kind of you to remember that. And I had just, as I say, I just remembered it myself a couple of weeks back.
Well, there was one where Phil and Remley were, you know, they were marching down the street behind an elephant or something, you know, on Hollywood Boulevard or some such thing like that. And I can remember, I just heard this not too long ago, as a matter of fact, and I, you know, there could be no way that you could do that on television.
No.
Never.
No. We did one, I remember, that Dick Chevalier and Ray Singer wrote, where they buy a racehorse, and the description of the racehorse was so hilarious, and of course you couldn't do it on television. You can't get a horse who's as is running slowly or cannot run more quickly because his stomach is dragging on the ground. But you know that these men would buy this and then consider it. Then they're talking about it and say, does it, you know, does it look right to you? And no, I think there's something wrong. All, no, a horse shouldn't look like that. And that they're, you know, it, marvelous, marvelous relationship, very well written by Ray Singer and Dick Chevalier.
They wrote the whole series. Huh?
They didn't write the first 26
weeks.
It
started on the Fitch bandwagon,
so.
Didn't it?
Right, and I wasn't on it at first. I was doing something else. And Remley, real Frank Remley, is a left-handed guitar player who worked with Phil's band and worked on the Benny Show. Dear, dear, marvelous man. Well, they decided when Phil and Alice had their own show, they decided that, you know, the thing to do would be to use Phil's best friend, Frankie. So they wrote it in and they said to Remley, you know, here you go. And he got up and he couldn't read it. He was a guitar player. He wasn't an actor. So I had worked with all of them a long time on the Benny Show. We all knew each other and were close friends. And I was doing a show down the hall. And Phil came in. They did the first show without me. And he came in and they cut the Remley thing. And he said, we're going to write Remley in on the second show. And, you know, the script is ready and we have to establish the relationship. And could you come in and do it? And it'll take you a couple of hours. And then that'll be the end of it. And I came in and I did it, and we got the kind of laughs that I've been describing to you, which neither of us understood, and we did it every week for 9 years. But that's how it happened. I think Mosier and Connolly wrote the first 26, Joe Connolly and Bob Mosier wrote the first 26 shows. Mm-hmm. Then Ray and Dick wrote it until possibly the last year when they were off on something else, and I have a memory of Marvin Fisher and Jack Douglas working on the show. Because I remember Jack wrote some wild, wild material. He's so funny anyway. Funny stuff. But Singer and Chevalier were responsible for the show.
Was there Rexall? Started with Fitch, and then Rexall came
right
in there.
And then RCA had it in the last couple of years.
In the 50s, more.
Yeah, we were working for the dog. His master's voice, you know. I remember that taking a couple of trips and, you know, where you're helping with the advertising and everything, and I remember those little statues. Mm-hmm. What's the dog's name? Didn't Crosby do a
Nipper?
Nipper.
Was it Nipper?
Nipper, yeah. He's the head cocked as he's listening in front of the speaker. I remember that very well.
Well, you did so much more in radio than just the Phil Harris and Alice Faye show, because that was... That actually was one of the greatest, funniest comedy shows on radio, with a storyline with the variety Phil and Alice singing.
Yeah.
But the continuity of characters, as you said, Walter Tetley was Julius.
Julius, the delivery boy. And Sheldon was all kinds of things, and was in and out as a friend of Phil's and Frankie's that Alice couldn't bear because he was so obviously conning everybody. The way Lenny does.
I have to ask, on the Benny Show, whenever they referred to Frankie Remley, he was, of course,
never heard
lush.
It. Yeah.
He was a drunkard. Now, was he really?
Oh, no.
That? No,
no. Very sweet, nice, quiet man. And a really dear man. I remember when he passed away, which is, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago now. I remember that I had a real pang. And I hadn't seen him in years, but he was... He was a dear man, very nice man.
It's interesting how they made a fictional character out of a real person.
Yes. Well, that's the secret of Jack Benny.
Uh-huh.
Jack Benny, who was the comedy genius of all time and who taught all of us, That was his theory, that you made jokes out of nothing. They would make a joke out of something that started at the beginning of a half-hour show. By the end of the show, you're laughing hysterically. Mm-hmm. Nothing funny, really. It wasn't a joke. But it was just, the gas man and the car and all of the things. The train to Cucamonga. And I remember a routine we did on the Benny Show where every year, Jack and the group go to New York, and that therefore is the scene in the railway station. And Frank Nelson is saying, yes. He's selling tickets, and Jack's in line, and Mel is on the speaker going, Dan Cucamonga, and every year we did this. And I was always the man in line in front of Jack, and Jack's trying to get a ticket, buy his ticket to go to New York. And the first routine that we did, and the reason we then continued it, was that we took the lyric of Glockamora, and all I did was read the lyric. And Jack was very nervous about it. He said, I don't know. Do you think you ought to be crazy? Or, is that going to be funny? And I said, I don't know. It just seems to me that it's funny if I just ask Frank Nelson these questions. How are things in Glockamora? And he says, fine. And I said, is that little brook still rippling there? And he said, oh, yes. Well, you could imagine. And you're doing this, Frank and I talking, and Jack Benny is standing behind me just staring at the audience with that look, when you did the elbow thing stuff. Well, what is funny about it? I don't know. It's just, but it was funny. It was funny stuff. And so Jack would create these characters, and he created the image of Phil and the image of therefore Remley. He created Phil and Remley, image for them and characters for them, so strong that Phil and I and Alice and the real little girls were in the Santa Claus Lane parade on Thanksgiving down Hollywood Boulevard one year, and it was freezing cold. And without thinking, we each took a mug of coffee, hot coffee. And the girls were all bundled up warm, and one of them, the kid sat on my lap, and the other kid was on Phil's lap. And we stopped at one place, and I reached to get the coffee. I was really shivering. I was so cold. And I picked it up, and Phil, without seeing that I was doing it, did the same thing, and he picked his up. And we had stopped, and there were crowds on either side of the street, and they started to laugh. They thought we were drinking booze. They thought we were stoned, and you don't know what to do. You got a little kid on your lap, and the audience is laughing because they think you're drinking whiskey, which we weren't. No. We're just hot coffee. But that's how firmly the Benny Show created those characters and established those characters. I remember doing a show Jack created for those characters, the fact that they were musicians who hadn't the faintest idea what they were doing. Knew no more about the music business, had no more right to be musicians. This was so firmly established that on Phil's show, then years later, we did a scene that I still recall of a music rehearsal. Phil is conducting and Remley's playing guitar, and Phil stops and says, wait a minute, doesn't sound right. What have you got there? He says to Remley. And Remley says, there's a black dot and then another black dot. And the audience started to laugh. Now, you figure they'd have to be musicians to know. They didn't. They just knew that we hadn't the vaguest idea what we were talking about. Phil said, I think there's supposed to be three black dots. He said, no, there's one here that's a white dot. And he said, where is it? And I don't know, whatever the thing. That's a fly. No, that's a real... all of these jokes. But people were laughing because the characters had been established by Jack.
There was one series of shows in the Harris and Fate sequence there that were somehow or other you, as Frankie Remley, signed the contract with Rexall instead of Phil. And Phil was, for two shows at least, it went on, And Alice, you were going to team up with Alice and do the whole thing.
I remember the biggest laugh we ever got, and I really, to show how little I know about what I'm doing, I had no idea would get this kind of laugh, and it made me kind of nervous. The story, very simply, was that Alice says to Phil, he is not, Remley is not your friend. He doesn't really care about you. He's a terrible, vile person who was looking to take advantage of you, and you got to be very careful. And Phil keeps saying, no, 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 no. That's not true. And they keep putting things in the way until finally they say, Phil says, all right, I tell you what. When he comes to the door this morning, you tell him I just died of a heart attack. And then you'll see what a friend I've got. Well, I thought, my goodness, are we really going to do that? Play the scene in front of the audience. Doorbell. Alice goes to the door. She's crying. And Remley says, what's the matter? What is it, Alice? And she says, Phil just died of a heart attack. And there was a long pause, and I said, Alice, will you marry me? Well, I tell you, we couldn't not stop the people from laughing. The studio was shaking. It was just this explosion of laughter that he had the gall. Didn't even wait, didn't say, gee, I'm sorry, nothing. Couldn't wait to get his hands on that money. And I thought, well, no, we really can't do that. Ray and Dick said, it's funny, do it. Just do it. Phil said, don't worry about it. Well, they were right.
Did you have to do a lot of rehearsal for that show?
No. As a matter of fact, by the time we were in our 7th, 8th, and 9th year, we were on tape. The show was no longer live. And we would record. We'd tape the show on a Friday for Sunday broadcast. And we would meet at around noon, around 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday, and read the script around the table and then make some cuts and changes. Then go get our lunch and come back and read it again on mic to balance it, make additional cuts and changes. And then I was producing and directing over at CBS. So Phil would go do his business and Alice do whatever she had to do. I'd go over and work on scripts for Suspense or On Stage or Broadway or one of the shows, Crime, that I was doing at CBS. And come back dressed to do a show in front of an audience at 5:30, and the audience would come in 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and we'd do a little warm-up and do the show from 6:30 to 7, and Phil and Alice got on the train, went back to Palm Springs, and I went home, and that was it. So we would devote most of a Friday to it, and that was about all.
Of course, by that time, the characters had been so refined and keenly developed.
You're able to do in radio, especially in comedy and radio, a kind of humor that you cannot do anywhere else. And once it is set up, as you have just said, the characters are set up, the situation is set up, and you have the kind of writing that we were getting from Ray Singer and Dick Chevalier, there are no problems. Everybody knows what they're doing, or they wouldn't be there. And if it wasn't a good show and the audience didn't like it, it wouldn't be on the air. You know, you find out very quickly whether it's working or not. And as always in almost anything, but especially in show business, if it's going easily, it's usually on the right track. It's not hard to have a hit. It's hard to have a failure because it's rough. You know, you keep trying to fix something that you should just throw away. When it's going well and all of the elements are together, wow, you know, and it's no problems. It just runs.
And then you said something about working in on the suspense in the production and the right. Did you do some of the writing for that too?
Yes, I did writing and editing and produced and directed Radio Suspense for about 5 years, I guess. And then while I was married to Kathy Lewis, we did the on-stage show for a couple of years, and I wrote the openings and the closings and did the editing on it. And E. Jack Newman, with whom I'm working here at Paramount, contributed, I would guess, half of the scripts during the 2 years that we worked on that show. Also wrote, goodness knows, how many of the suspense shows. As a matter of fact, he and I were talking the other day. There was a thing we would do together that was kind of fun because it was a kind of challenge in the mystery sense. I recall saying to him one day, driving into work, I had seen a scene in my mind, which was a marvelous first act curtain. So I said to Jack, you know, I just see this guy's, somebody's chasing a man, and he's in the fun house at an amusement park. And he knows he can't get out the front door, so he tries to get out, find if there's another exit. And in the back of this building, there's an enormous animated figure, a big, jolly kind of a animated stuffed thing. And its arms are at its side, and it goes, ho, 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 ho. And as it's doing ho, ho, the arms raise over its head, ho. And then the arms go down. And the man describes this in the narrative, and I said, because what he does is he times it. And the guys are chasing him, and so he waits, and the figure goes, ho, 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 and the arms are up, and he's going to make a dash. And so he waits, and he times it, and goes, ho, 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 and he starts to dash, and as he starts, the arms go, bang, cut off. There's a door behind him when it raises. And as he heads for the door, the arms come down from inside the figure, a voice says, you didn't really think I was going to let you get out, did you? So I said, I don't know who he is or how he got there, how it ends. Jack says, great idea. And he wrote a script that was called The Giant of Thermopylae. A marvelous suspense.
That was on Suspense.
It was on, we did on Suspense, yeah. We did a lot of them that way.
Was this in the late 40s then, the Suspense, when you were involved?
Yes, I did it. After I had been on Suspense, working with Bill Spear, for Bill Spear, as an actor and a rewrite man, and also writing originals, before World War II. Then I was in the service and didn't do any work for that, although I was working for Army Radio, Armed Forces Radio. I was in charge of what they called commercial denaturing, which was a division with Duff. Howie and I were doing that together. And we supplied 476 radio stations, Howie and I and three other guys, with 120 programs a week, which we took off the air, edited, took the commercials out, took out anything, any dating material. By edited, I mean anything that would be considered information that you didn't want broadcast worldwide. Mm-hmm. These were then placed on acetates, sent to the shortwave stations, then masters were made, they were printed, and they were shipped all over the world, all of these 470-odd radio stations. So I was busy doing that. Then when the war was over and I went back onto Suspense, Spear, Bill, who was doing Sam Spade and Suspense, wanted to do a picture in Europe with his wife at that time, June Haddock, and with James and Pamela Mason. It would be based, James and June would be the stars. Pamela had written a book that she was doing the adaptation on. Bill would produce and direct the film. So he wanted to get out of his deal, and he suggested to CBS that since I'd done so much work on it and I was doing producing and directing another radio show for them at the time called Broadway's My Beat, that David Friedkin and Mort Fein were writing, that I should produce and direct Suspense. They were agreeable, and so that's when I picked up Suspense, and Bill went off. And I think I did some of the Spades for him, too. I don't remember.
You were Gregory Hood.
I was Gregory Hood. Yes.
The casebook of Gregory Hood.
Casebook of Gregory Hood, Anthony Boucher. And I thought of it the other day. I was reading, somebody wrote a lovely thing about Anthony Boucher, about what a nice man he was. And I met and I had the privilege of meeting him in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He was up there so much. Of course, he was the crime not reporter, the reviewer for the New York Times. While he was alive. He was a fascinating man. And the casebook of Gregory Hood, we did down here. Howard McNear was Sandy. I remember they used to, they'd write at the end of a scene, Gregory Hood says so-and-so and so-and-so, and then they'd write for Sandy, makes funny noises. Because Howard McNear would always, I'd say, well, let's get going then, shall we, Sandy? And Howard would go, no one can do it the way he did. And it was marvelous, and it was always that kind of a thing. He was another very, very nice man.
Before,
a lot of good people in this business.
Before you took over the role of Gregory Hood, I think Gail Gordon.
Yes.
Was
Gail and I had known each other for years, and in the true manner of show business, I was called one day to the Young and Rubicam Advertising Agency, and they said, we have a property called Gregory Hood. Have you ever heard it? And I said, well, it's on the air, isn't it? And they said, yes, but it's not working out the way we want it. We would like you to be the star. And I said, what happened to Gail? And they said, well, we've told him, and he agrees, and, you know, no hard feelings or anything, and they were trying it. And so, you know, come to rehearsal Monday, and you're Gregory Hood. I said, fine. I walked into the studio, and there sat Gail. Nobody had said a word to her. So I said, Gail, why don't we go outside and have a cup of coffee and have a little talk, because we were old friends. So I was the one who was supposed to have been all arranged. I was the one who said to Gail, I'm doing Gregory Hood now. I guess you're not. Didn't matter, of course. You know,
well, he had a scratch for work then through the rest of his career, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he really was desperately looking here and there, trying to find something to do. And then when I was producing the Lucy show on television, of course, here we are working together again. Uh-huh. I'm producing the show, and he's, as a matter of fact, when we started the television series, the Lucy show that I produced, is when she came back from New York, and she and Desi had been divorced. She was about to marry Gary. The whole thing at the studio was going on. And Bob and Maddie and the two Bobs were writing the show. And we all sat around, and we said, gee, we need somebody that really can, you know, hey, let's get Gail. And that's how that started. We wrote in the Mr. Mooney character, and Gail came in. And
well, he stayed with Lucy then. Until it finally went off the air a year or so ago.
Right.
You followed him again on another series called Junior Miss. For a while, I believe you played Judy Graves' father, and before you, or maybe it was after you, I don't know. He was in there, too.
I think he may have followed me, because I remember doing, that was the one Shirley Temple did, didn't it? Junior Miss?
Yeah, it was Junior Miss. I don't know if Shirley actually...
I did Junior Miss with Shirley.
Oh, well, that was pretty
and
early.
And I played her father. And I was playing her father the week I was drafted. So I was like 22. I was playing Shirley Temple's father, and I did the Junior Miss show on a Thursday or something, waved bye-bye, and Friday went into the Army. So I think Gail followed me on that show, and then I think Shirley dropped out, and they did another version of it later on. We're talking another funny, there was a show called Date with Judy that was on for a long time. And one of my friends out here also is Dick Crenna. And Dick and I were kidding one day because I said, you know, you may be famous for the playing the part of Oogie on a Date with Judy, but I created it. He said, I didn't know that. And I said, yeah. It was a mistake. It was a double. I was there doing something else, and there were a couple of lines in for a kid named Oogie. So I did it, and my voice broke, and, you know, played the part of Oogie, and I was busy doing something else and wasn't really very good anyway. And they called Crenna, and Crenna did Oogie on a Date with Judy. It's hard to believe all of those things happened. Because we did so many shows, you know.
How busy were you at your busiest as far as being...
Week I did 20 shows in one capacity or another. I was finally in the late 50s, or middle 50s, I guess. I was involved in the production, direction, acting, whatever, on 5 weekly series. My desk at CBS looked like a joke. I was doing the Harris Show as an actor. I was producing and directing Suspense. I was producing, directing, editing, writing openings and closings, and co-starring in On Stage. I was producing and directing Broadway's My Beat, and I was producing, directing, and writing the openings and closings and editing Crime Classics. And at one point, CBS had 3 of those shows on back-to-back on Wednesday night. And by taping parts of this one and sections of that one, because you couldn't record the music had to be live and had to be put in when you went on the air, and having adjoining studios... Studios 1 and 2 at the old CBS, I was able to do it. I was on the air. I had a show on the air from 5:30 to 6, and I had a show on the air from 6 to 6:30, and I had a show on the air from 6:30 to 7. I mean, to network feed. Some of them, I think the 6:30 to 7 was also live on the coast. The others came on a little later on.
It was Elliot Lewis night on CBS.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. You know, there's no reason for that. It was just silly. But that's just the way the scheduling happened.
I want to back up to your Army career for a moment or so.
Yeah.
You were working on the editing and
all of those
dubbing those
commercial
the radio shows.
Right.
Did you start that? Were you the first one to get involved with that?
I think Howie and I were, Duff, when I say Howie. We were both in the service at different places and were called here by Colonel Tom Lewis, who we had known when Tom was the head of Young and Rubicam. And he needed people who knew radio, and he had this thing starting, and he needed people to take over this job that had been handled by Don Sharp, who had been an agent and a producer and everything else in town. And at that point, I believe Don was working for, was it the OWI? Office of War Information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was working for the OWI, and they were trying this, but nobody had done anything with it yet. So there, Duff and I were there, and we're called in, and they said, now here's what we want to do. And as a matter of fact, some of the things we developed, I won't be bashful. Some of the things we developed worked so well that I was given the Legion of Merit for developing this new techniques in recording and broadcasting.
How did you
only get because there was no other way to do it?
Well, but that was
we had three civilian crews working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, to reassemble these shows by the techniques that we developed of cut disc pickup here and so forth. And this is before tape.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing this editing off of acetate. So we got so we could look at a turntable playing at 33 and a third speed and drop the head on a word or a spot. You could look at the grooves in the right light and you know exactly where you are and what you're doing.
You picked up the shows as they were being broadcast, more or less, right off the line then.
Off the line at radio recorders. They were taken off the line. Howard and I would pick them up in an Army vehicle, which was given to us occasionally. The rest of the time we were to use our own car and our own gasoline and were never reimbursed for it. And we had to be very, very careful because we had a stack. These were not aluminum-based acetates. They were glass-based. And we had one guy cut in front of us on the way to the studio one night, and we lost 2 hours of programming because the records just slid, and that was it. Nothing you could do about it. They were gone. But they were glass-based acetates that we took off the air. We picked them up. And what we tried to do with the immediate shows is that we would make worksheets on a typewriter as the show was on the air. So when we picked it up and delivered that acetate to McGregor's or to Universal or to the other part of the division of radio recorders, they had the worksheet and the crew knew exactly what they were going to do with that. And by the following morning, that show would be ready to be broadcast shortwave. So that we were watching a clock, timing when a commercial began, when a new opening was to be put in, this would be to taken out, what the fill material was to make up for what we
You always had to pad it back to 30 minutes again, or
right.
29, whatever.
29:30,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it got to be quite a thing. As I think about it now, I don't know how in heaven's name we did it. Because as we were typing, we were listening to a show and watching a clock. And
what you
I never did
though,
learn how to type.
I mentioned this to Howard Duff. What you fellas did there, and you really didn't realize you were doing it, but you were really preserving the sounds of radio from
right.
the 40s.
Right.
Because the
There's
networks never wanted to keep it. You know,
right.
And they just did it live, and they didn't copy
There's
it.
A complete record of all of that stuff, and I believe Armed Forces Radio Service mm-hmm. still has those things, and they still do it. Somebody told me that they had heard my voice on a program broadcast over the Armed Forces Network somewhere in Europe 6 months or so ago. Because what we did, if we didn't have enough material coming off the line to make 52 weeks of something, we invented. So we invented the Mystery Theater.
Mm.
Now, the Mystery Theater had to have a host because sometimes it would be Mr. and Mrs. North, sometimes it would be Inner Sanctum. whatever was on the air that was a mystery show that we could use. Mm-hmm. We'd grab and we'd put it on. So we had our own opening and our own closing. Now, whichever of us went down with the record, with the transcription to make the show, also recorded an opening and closing for that show. So we had to invent characters because it was not the same person. So there was Corporal X and there was Sergeant Y, and we did all of these things. Whoever went down was Howard, or was Jerry Hausner, or was me, or it was Jimmy Lyons, who was part of our group and now runs the Monterey Jazz Festival. But we all fell into the patterns. Alan Hewitt loved opera and symphony, so he would edit opera and symphony. Jimmy Lyons, doing Monterey, loved jazz, knew all of those people. He did all of that kind of music. Howie and I did the dramatic things and the comedy things. Hausner did all of those and did also 15 and 30 minute original shows for everybody. But we were kind of the lost group. We were in a side corner because the big shows that this Armed Forces Radio Service was doing were command performance and things like that. The people talked about, and let's get out there and do it. And they did one command performance a week while we were doing 120 shows, and nobody even knew we were there. You know, we were just off in the back somewhere.
Did you ever meet G.I. Jill? There was a little 15-minute...
Marty Williamson? What's Marty's last name? All I can think of is a married name. It's Mort Werner's wife. Mort Werner was the head man at NBC Television for I don't know how long. I think Mort's trying to retire now. G.I. Jill was Marty, was his wife. And Mort, who at that time was a G.I. with the rest of us, Corporal Werner, was kind of producing and directing his wife's little show. You know?
I've heard a lot of those G.I. Jill shows now. What did she look like?
Marty's a very, very... She was a lovely-looking young woman. She's a very attractive older woman now. They have grown children. I don't figure they're contemporaries of mine, so she's no longer a young woman. Not a raving beauty, just a marvelous-looking woman. Warm, very attractive. To me, she always looked like what she sounded like, you know.
That's great. That's good.
It was just wonderful. And a...
She
lovely,
had to be every girl
person.
Next door for every GI around the world.
But Marty primarily was a writer. She wasn't doing that. She wrote, has written many, many, many television things. She wrote for the Robert Montgomery show, wrote original material for it.
You were, back to civilian life, you were the lead, I believe, in a kind of another version of the First Nighter program called Knickerbocker Playhouse.
Yes, they called me to go to Chicago. That's when I went to Chicago in 39. I knew nothing about this program. I was working as an actor on a lot of shows here, and one of the shows I was working on was called Silver Theater, which was a Sunday afternoon drama. And I was under contract to them. The AFRA at that time, contract, stated that you could pay people, if you signed them to a 13-week deal, they got scale less 10%. So I was under contract to Silver Theater in Big Town at that time. Now, on Silver Theater, some weeks I had four lines, and some weeks I was the leading man opposite whoever the leading woman was. And this one time, they had heard me opposite, as a leading man opposite Ginger Rogers or somebody, I don't know who. And they were out here, and I knew nothing about this. And my agent called me and said, there are some people here from Chicago, and they would like you to audition for them. There's some kind of radio show that they're going to be doing in Chicago. And they're over across the hall, and would you go over and read something for them? Now, I'm in the middle of a Silver Theater rehearsal playing the lead opposite Rosalind Russell, a darling, lovely, gifted, talented lady. So I came back in, and I must have looked puzzled, and she said, what's the matter? And I told her, and she said, well, we'll stop rehearsing for a little bit and go over and do it. It could be a big job for you. I said, I don't know what to read. She said, let's read what we're doing. I said, we? She said, sure. Don't tell them who I am. We'll go over and we'll read. I'll read with you. We went across the street to this other studio and went in, and I still don't think they knew who it was. She said, tell them I'm Miss Brown. So I said, this is Miss Brown, she's going to read with me. And they said, fine, how are you? And fine, we read the scene, which we'd been rehearsing for 2 days. they said, thank you very much, and I said, thank you, and Roz and I went back and did our work. And the following day, I got a call from my agent, and he said, they want you, the show is called Knickerbocker Playhouse, and it's going to come from Chicago, and they want you to be the star, and you want to go to Chicago this summer, it's Firm 13. So I said, well, I've never been in Chicago, that sounds to be a lot of fun, I'll drive to Chicago. And I did, and they said, bring a tuxedo, because they get all dressed up. I said, I didn't know where to live. And so I checked into the Medina Club, which was across the street from the Wrigley Building, and do the show there. Then I got an apartment on Wabash. And the woman to whom I have been married for these 17 years, Mary Jane Croft, was coming through town on her way to New York. She had been working in Cincinnati. And that's when we met one another. Then she married somebody else, and I married somebody else, and she was divorced, and I was divorced, and we've been married for 17 years. And we met in Chicago, 1939.
The Windy City.
Yeah, 720 North Wabash.
I thought you were going to say that they didn't want you, but they wanted the Miss Brown.
Yeah, they wanted Rob. No, I told them later who it was, and they said, well, we knew. And they sure didn't act like they knew. They had any idea who she was.
You played in I Love a Mystery and One Man's Family.
Just as an actor that was,
roles,
called in because they were all friends. We all worked in anything, yeah. You know, it didn't matter. It was marvelous. And it was, because you could do anything. You go in and you do four lines, or you wrote it, or you were directing it, or you produced it. Mm-hmm. Everybody was interchangeable, and it was a marvelous way of working, a very pleasant way.
Not too long ago, might have been just a year or two back, you were involved in the production of New Time Radio as opposed to Old
yes.
Time Radio.
Yeah, we did. I got a call and somebody wanted to do a show, and we worked out a format and a thing with Rod Serling, bless his heart, as host. And I did 65 half hours for them. And then they sold it to the Mutual Network. And decided that, I don't know what, I was never consulted, and I don't know what happened to the show after that. Somebody else did it. They decided they'd go non-union, and they bought some old radio scripts from someone and said, well, we'll revise these. And I heard a couple of them, and they were very disappointed. And the show was canceled. It didn't do well with it. Not that it would not have been canceled if I had continued, but I think there's an unfortunate thing in the entertainment business. If it's properly done, whatever it is, what you do, what I do, what Jack does, if it's properly done, it looks to somebody on the outside like, well, that's nothing to it. Mm. You know, I can do that. I just turn on a machine and hold a microphone in the fellow's face and ask him questions. Great. But there's more to it than that. And unfortunately, a lot of people have come in the history of the entertainment business, from the Greeks, I suppose, where somebody said, well, you know, if he thinks he can write a play, what if you see what I write? You know, what's so great about the frogs? I'll write a play called The Gypsies or whatever. You know, well, there's a talent to it. So a lot of things get screwed up, unfortunately.
You're quite busy these days, and exactly what are you doing right now?
Right now I'm working on a couple of projects with E-Jack Newman, and we just completed yesterday the presentation for the pilot of a new show, and if you heard any typing during this discussion, that's what's being typed, and we'll see if we're going to proceed. While we're waiting on that, we have two others that Jack and I have been working on, and so that's my immediate project. As I told you, I had the pleasure of standing opposite Sheldon Leonard and acting, which was quite a thrill a couple of weeks ago, and that pleased me.
Are you on the premiere show now?
No, it opened last week. I'm on the second show, which is the one that the next one coming up. And as a matter of fact, I got a phone call from a friend last night. Mary Jane and I were sitting watching television. The phone rang at 9 o'clock, and an old friend called and said, didn't you see yourself? And I said, no, that's not till Saturday. And Joanne said, No, you're in the promos all this week.
Oh.
She said, they're just a promo. You and Sheldon are just talking, just ahead of Hawaii 5-0. So I'm anxious to see the promo, to see what I look like as an elderly person. I haven't seen that in 25 years.
Well, you have had an interesting career, when it will still continue, and you're not an elderly person.
No, I
know,
teasing.
On the show.
No, I just meant physically, as I look at the image, I say, who's that? That doesn't look like the guy that was in Chicago. Well, it isn't, except it is. And all of us, Ejack, David, Mort, all of us who work together, have worked together in so many different relationships and capacities for so many years. You always think of yourself as the way you always were when you talked about Phil. I saw Phil maybe a couple of years ago. He called. He was coming into town and wanted to know if I wanted to have breakfast with him because he's an early riser. Because he was in the band business for so long, the two things he hates are staying up late and wearing a tuxedo. And his idea of heaven is if you go to bed early and you get up at 5:30 and you wander around and see a sunrise fresh, not just as you're ready to go to sleep. And if you wear old clothes and hang around the kitchen and cook and do things like that. So we met and we had breakfast and chatted, and it's like we hadn't seen each other in 5 or 6 years. Just picking up where we'd left off.
I wish you guys could pick up where you left off. It'd be great to hear Frankie and Phil again.
I don't know what happened to all of those shows, whether he'd be interested in putting them on the radio or not. Pardon me. I know that I was asked to do a radiothon a year ago, and they had a piece of one of the old shows. Mm-hmm. And I know I was laughing wholeheartedly, and your memory of scenes also makes me chuckle. They were funny shows.
Great shows. Yeah, thank you very much for doing
those.
Thank
you. This was a lot of fun. I appreciated it.
Thank you, Elliot Lewis.